You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a UW Stout Honor Society has been sending people cards just to make their lives a little brighter. We'll hear about the Spread the Love campaign.
First, new research just released earlier today offers what would be a startling revision to theories of when humans first arrived here on the North American continent. Like, really startling, factor of 10 different than previously believed.
The findings, which were published in Nature, point to evidence found in Southern California that could turn previous thinking on its head, but a lot of researchers are skeptical about the findings.
John Hawks joins us now to explain the significance of the find. He's the Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor in the Department of Anthropology at UW-Madison. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, glad to be here.
Well, before we get into the pros and cons of the reaction to this find, can you talk us through what was in this Nature Journal article? What did they say they found?
Yeah, this was a group of researchers who are reevaluating evidence from what we had considered to be too early sites to be, you know, representing very ancient occupation of the Americas by humans. They've been going back to sites looking for evidence that maybe somebody was there that we hadn't recognized. And so they were looking at more ancient kills of mammoths and mastodons and other kinds of extinct animals, just looking for any evidence that humans had been involved. This site is one that was excavated in the early 1990s, actually. It was identified during a road cut, I think, in Southern California outside San Diego. And it contains the remains of a mastodon and some other kinds of creatures. And these researchers from a private research organization went in and they looked at it and they said, oh, we think that these mastodon bones were broken intentionally. It looks like they've got marks that were made by them being broken when they were fresh by being hit with hammer stones. And they had hammer stones in the site with flakes that had been removed from the hammer stones, presumably by knocking them into the mastodon bones. And so they had all that documented. And they said, well, this is very interesting. Anytime that there's an extinct animal involved, it's interesting because it could be very, very old, one of the earliest sites in the Americas. They took the mastodon bones and teeth to have dated with radiocarbon, that's carbon-14 dating, and there was no result. They were too old. And so then they used a technique that's based on the absorption of uranium from the groundwater into the mastodon bones, and they discovered that the bones appear to be 130,000 years old. Now, that's almost 10 times older than we have any really good evidence of humans in the Americas. So this is like, wow, this is really, really interesting. There's something very anomalous here.
Right. The conversation had been maybe 10, 15,000 years ago, the first humans here. Some people have made claims for, 25 or even 40,000. That still seemed dicey. So this jump would be, if it were backed up, huge, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this would be transformational in the sense that that age, 130,000 years, is earlier than we have any documented appearance of humans in the high latitudes of the old world. You know, we've got humans in Siberia, you know, fairly early, 300,000 years ago, but in the very southern tier of Siberia. And you sort of have to go up the eastern coast of Asia around, you know, the very far up to high latitudes before you're able to get across that landmass when sea levels were low that we call Beringia. Now, you could walk to North America, but you've got to make it in those northern climates in order to do so, and you've got to be able to survive there. And so we hadn't thought that people had done that until modern humans were on the scene and until there was, you know, the ability to travel along the coast and use a larger space in this sort of really hard to live in high latitude.
Talking to John Hawks, professor of anthropology at UW-Madison, looking at research unveiled today, the journal Nature, saying maybe some form of humans were on this continent, North America, over 100,000 years ago, changing the number from like 10,000 or so years ago. So, John, we've got this mastodon, we've got it's been worked on, these researchers say. There are these tools, stone tools that may have been used on it, but not everybody is on board as they're looking at this. What's been some of the reaction in the world of anthropology?
Well, because it would be such a jump in evidence, people, archaeologists, are looking for a very, very high standard. They're saying, you know, show us the direct evidence that humans really, really did, you know, hit these rocks. And typically we look for intentional signs of flaking, making artifacts that are clearly different from a natural rock, you know, something that you pick up and recognize and say, oh, humans made this. These are not that. They are hammer stones, which are round, basically cobbles. They have clearly been hit on something because they've shattered and flakes of them are off. But they're recognized as tools by these researchers because of the association, because they're in this context where somebody seems to have maybe used tools, and they're in a silty sort of ancient riverbed, slow-moving water situation where there's not a lot of rocks around, and these stand out as anomalous. And so the researcher's argument is that, you know, this in a more recent time period, you'd recognize as probably archaeological site. And the evidence seems good, even though there's not this really, really, you know, very clear, somebody made this thing, and we've got, you know, lots and lots of evidence, you know, about the date of things all the way around it. And so archaeologists who are not, you know, part of this study are saying, you know, we really want some extraordinary evidence here. You know, we want something that is, you know, all of us would look at and say, oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And John, you're not involved in this study directly, but obviously this is of interest to you, this issue. How excited are you getting about what you've seen in this study?
You know, when I got this, when it was sent to me, I took a very close look at it. I saw that, you know, this is something where the evidence is going to go one way or the other. You know, I looking at it, it's not like a smoking gun. You know, you have to sort of put together the different elements of it as an argument that there's something really here. But I am excited because in a sense, we know over the last 15 years of discoveries in archaeology, anthropology, we keep finding things that we didn't expect to find. And that's exciting to me. The work that I've been involved in South Africa, you're finding things you didn't expect to find, and that's true almost everywhere. It is really true that when we look back at the past, there are these big spaces of the world and big spaces of time that we haven't looked at closely enough to know everything that's there. And the New World may be one of those cases. It's certainly a case where in the last 15 years we've transformed from thinking that no humans could have been here before 14,000 years ago to acknowledging that we have some older sites and maybe humans were here 17, 18, 20,000 years ago. Now, accepting a 130,000-year-old site would be a really, really big jump.
John, as we wrap up, let's talk about how we in the public maybe think of science. And I remember at certain stages of learning, you know, there was the chart and here's the human family tree and it looked like it was a done deal, but things are still changing. And that's kind of more how science works. It's not, okay, we got it all, it's carved in stone, is it?
No. We're always, always working to make new discoveries. And, you know, a lot of people look at science and say, well, you guys think you know all the answers. And when you're inside of science, it's the absolute opposite case, right? I wish I knew some answers. What I know is that if I keep looking for things and keep making logical predictions and then test them, collect some data and figure it out, then I will either find out that, yeah, we pretty much had a good idea of what was going on, or I'll find out, dang, we were wrong, and we've got to develop some new ideas. And we have seen a lot of new ideas coming out in the last 15 years because there are big parts of the past that we're just starting to learn about.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's John Hawks, professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about the significance or potential significance. New findings released today that date the human presence, if confirmed, in North America way, way earlier than previously thought.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
We might not have mountains here, but mountain music has been taking off in Wisconsin. Art Stevenson has been playing bluegrass in the Midwest for 25 years. And for most fans, Stevenson is bluegrass in Wisconsin. Eli Frieders brings us his story.
My name is Art Stevenson. I do quite a number of things in this life, including play music and run events and teach science. I work for the Department of Physics and Astronomy here at UWSP, and I teach the physics introductory labs and also the astronomy introductory labs. I'm pretty much a lab instructor.
Let me pause briefly to provide some clarity to art modesty. In central Wisconsin, Art Stevenson is considered to most as bluegrass royalty. He is an executive member of the International Bluegrass Music Association and has led his own group, Art Stevenson and Highwater, for over two decades. So, Art, who are your three biggest musical influences?
Well, it's pretty easy. I would have to say Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers, and then the third spot is kind of a tie between people like Flatten Scruggs and Jimmy Martin and Del McCurry. So I guess I cheated there and gave you five names.
It works.
So I really love the Stanley Brothers, and of course Bill Monroe too, but I love the Stanley Brothers singing together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you knew it was the Stanley Brothers when you heard them sing the first few lines.
Oh, come, angel.
You know, it was Carter Stanley singing the lead, and of course Ralph's tenor was easily identifiable as a distinction, you know, for them. Part of what we base our music on, a big part, is just, you know, our singing, me and Stephanie. You know, she sings the tenor, I sing the lead, and I'll sing the verses, and she'll sing along in the chorus.
California cotton fields, where labor camps are filled with buried men with broken dreams.
So I got to just say that I wouldn't want to be in the band without her. It's our band, really. Even though it's got my name on the front, it's Art and Stephanie, you know, along with Dale and Bruce.
That's Art referring to the rest of the Highwater band, Dale Reichert on banjo, Bruce King on mandolin, and his partner in both marriage and music for 22 years, Stephanie Stevenson. So when was the inception of Highwater, and how did the band get started?
Well, we formed in 1993, and I had a gig at a place called Schmidt's Corners out in Waupaca County, which is still there. And we played there every Thursday night, and we ran it as an open mic. We played our bluegrass just as a three-piece, just me and Stephanie and Dale. At that time, I was working on a solo record, and I just was bold enough to send it out to lots of radio stations all over the country, you know, as many as I could think of. And not long after that, we started to get offers to play festivals. But yeah, it all started in that little bar out there in the country, and we used to pack that place on Thursday night, you know. And so, none of us really know what's going to happen next. No one knows where this is going to carry us or where it's going to go. But yeah, it's great. I'm glad to be part of the scene.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, sometimes a small gesture can really make a difference in someone's day, and kind deeds can have a ripple effect.
With that in mind, an honor society at UW-Stout decided to create a project that would bring joy to various groups, individuals, and even random people who might need a lift.
Wisconsin native Sarah Bedford is vice president of professional program Phi Upsilon Omicron Honor Society in Family and Consumer Sciences at UW-Stout. Bedford is enrolled in the master's program in food and nutritional sciences. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Carolyn Barnhart is with us. She's an emeritus professor from the University of Wisconsin-Stout, advisor for Phi Upsilon Omicron at UW-Stout. And Carolyn, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Sarah, I'm going to start with you. Where did the idea for the Spread the Love project come from?
Well, as our Phi Upsilon Omicron Honor Society, we like to do service projects that involve the campus, the community, and at the start of the semester, we noticed that there was a lot of negativity around us. Even when you just popped on Facebook for a couple seconds, when you turn on the news, there's a lot of negativity. And it especially hit home to our Stout campus when a student of ours was assaulted and died. And so we were wanting to find ways to spread positivity throughout, bring out the positivity and the negative aspects around us. And so we thought that by doing small acts of kindness through making homemade cards, we could make an impact on many people around us throughout our own campus, throughout community members, and even around the world.
So who was on that first list or two who was going to end up as recipients of these cards?
Well, one of our things that we like to do yearly is make Cards for Kids, which is an organization that sends cards to children who are hospitalized and traumatized around the globe. And so we just make simple uplifting cards to encourage them to keep conquering their battles. And then we also decided to make cards for the elderly and the neighbor and the nearby nursing homes, because they often go forgotten, and we wanted to remind them that they still matter and that they are important.
And what kind of things did the cards say? Can you give me a couple examples?
So the cards for kids were they more utilize encouragement. We didn't want to bring the trauma back to them, so it was just like little simple things like "You rock," "You're the best." And like for the cards for the elderly, we actually just got done creating them, and so it was just uplifting little quotes for springtime and that kind of a thing. And then we also made cards for the military that we sent overseas around Christmas time, so those just included simple happy holidays and thank you for your service and just showing our appreciation for them.
And Carolyn, as the advisor for the Honor Society, what was your first thought when they brought this idea to you?
I was in the discussion as it was taking place and evolving, and their creativity, I was impressed by it. And their willingness to do something and to become part of the solution on our campus. In fact, we even had people donate cards to us to fill out, to leave in random places around campus and on bulletin boards with positive sayings. I was stout proud of them.
Well, you know what? We have a caller right now. Let's take Christina in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I just want you to know that I received some love from the University Stout in the form of a happy birthday email. And as a person who makes a really big deal out of my birthday by celebrating the entire month of February, that really added to the festivities. And I have kept that email, and I will look at it from time to time, and it just makes me smile.
Wow. So you got one of these cards, or was it an email form?
I got an email from the UW Stout. I thought, oh, my gosh, yes, saying happy birthday.
Oh, well, Christina, thank you for sharing that. And it sounds as though, you know, this kind of positivity is much needed for people like Christina. It can really make a difference. Sarah, what kind of stories did you hear from people who had gotten some of these cards?
Well, members actually personally hand-delivered the cards to the elderly, and they were just extremely shocked and appreciated that they were remembered. And even spending that extra, like, 2-3 minute conversation with them, they felt loved and appreciated. And there was also the specific Share the Love campaign on campus was kind of more like indirect acts of kindness. So we filled out these cards and we left them in various places. And one of the places that we left them were in the classroom that we hold our meetings at. And the custodian actually came up to me and was all like, I found these cards. And she's like, I was having a bad day, and I saw this card that says, you know, smile and a positive quote. And she goes, it really made my day. And I was like, well, actually, that was from FIU. And so it was just more of the feedback was they almost didn't realize that they needed a positive uplifting, but when they saw the card or received the card, it made them feel better. And that was the goal of FIU, was to spread kindness and love to others, so hopefully they would spread it on to others as well.
And Carolyn, did you expect this to have such an impact, these simple messages of kindness delivered via cards to strangers and to people who are known, and also just to be left in classrooms? It seems like it had packed a punch. Did you expect that?
Well, it far exceeded our expectations, and it seemed to grow. And the members started, they were more positive about what was going on. So I think we were healed in the process. So many times the giver is also the receiver. The birthday bags that went to the children with birthday cards inserted through our stepping stones, they donated clothing to people in need in the county, and they actually inserted cards. And I don't know who they went to, but I know there was a positive receivership because the heads of these organizations thanked us. They said, oh, yes, I know they'll be happy.
And, Sarah, I think Carolyn really hit on something there. She said the giver is often the receiver. Did you feel like that was true for you and other fellow students, advisors who helped with this, who made these cards? Did you feel like you got a lot back, maybe more even than you felt like you were giving?
Yeah, I do especially agree with that, and I know a lot of members in the Tao chapter agree with it. Because of the negativity, and it was very saddening conversations during the beginning of the year, and through making those cards at each chapter meeting, you felt like you were making a difference. And because all of our majors in the FIU are about service and helping others, I think we felt like we weren't just sitting on the sidelines and watching it happen. We wanted to be a change. And so even though they might have been a small card, but we knew it was making an impact in somebody's life. And so that made us feel more positive and be more positive in our own lives and to those around us.
Well, Sarah, so great to hear about this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Carolyn, a pleasure to have you with us, too.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. And that was Sarah Student Bedford and advisor Carolyn Barnard joining us to talk about the Spread the Love project of the Phi Epsilon Omicron Honor Society at UW-Stout. The group has been sending homemade cards to people to spread positivity in their community and beyond.
Yesterday, a federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's effort to withhold federal money from so-called sanctuary cities. These are cities that limit their cooperation with immigration enforcement.
Just a minute, we'll talk to an expert about this news and immigration policy under President Trump. First, we're getting a local perspective from Chuck Kornbach, WPR news reporter based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, Chuck, how is this ruling being received in Milwaukee?
Well, it's being called by county officials a partial victory or a major victory. They're very happy that the judge in San Francisco has at least temporarily blocked President Trump's executive order trying to limit federal funds if communities limit their cooperation with immigration enforcement. But there's a wrinkle here in Milwaukee County.
What's the wrinkle?
Well, of course, that last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions sent letters to Milwaukee County and eight other communities around the U.S. Asking the county to demonstrate its compliance with a federal rule that prohibits local and state governments from limiting communication with the Department of Homeland Security about the immigration status of individuals. We're especially talking about undocumented residents. The federal government, Trump administration, feels that some local law enforcement aren't sharing enough information with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And there was an updated statement today from Milwaukee County about that letter.
And what was in the letter?
Well, it says that this is, again, according to the Milwaukee County Board, at issue, they say, is a 2012 resolution that places condition on honoring requests for detaining some individuals. The county says immigration detainers are not mandatory, and they say the 2012 resolution does not restrict information about sharing immigration status. And therefore, the county is not in violation of the federal rule that Attorney General Sessions recently wrote about. Hmm.
So what happens next? Are there teeth in this back and forth on the behalf of the federal government?
Well, this, you know, a statement today from Milwaukee County, I was told yesterday by County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievic, that the County Corporation Council, law enforcement, and others are working to provide more formal response to the federal government. Attorney General Sessions gave the county and the other jurisdictions about 2 months to reply, so they say they're going to have something more formal for the federal government. But this a document today, this press release today, seems to be the basis of their argument.
And looking at the bigger issue of funding from the federal government for so-called sanctuary cities, is there funding on the line in Milwaukee?
Yeah, it's about $900,000, a public safety grant that goes to both some to the Milwaukee Police Department and some to the prosecution, the District Attorney's Office for prosecution efforts. So it's not a small amount of money. Of course, it's not as large as some of the other communities are being faced with challenges to their federal monies, but it's sizable. And, you know, I don't think Milwaukee County wants to lose the money, but they're going to have to, according to this effort so far from Attorney General Sessions, they're going to have to really spell out how they're complying, or at least how they're not blocking communication with ICE.
Well, thanks a lot for that update, Chuck. We'll have to keep tracking that with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Chuck Kornbach, WPR News reporter based in Milwaukee. And Sarah McKinnon joins us now for more on the ruling and what it means for immigration policy. She's an associate professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Sarah, to be clear, what is a sanctuary city? Do we have an agreed-on working definition?
Yeah, this is a very confusing term. And in part, it's because there is no working definition of what this is or concrete definition. I think one of the things that's clear and important to understand is the difference between the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, which was a movement to assist Central American refugees that were fleeing civil war. And this was a movement that happened in mostly in the U.S. Southwest in churches, and what we think about today as sanctuary cities. And sanctuary cities, again, there is no concrete definition, but basically what it means is that sanctuary cities will not or basically choose not to have a relationship, communication between local law enforcement and immigration and customs enforcement officials. And this can look a lot of different ways. And it's not just cities, it's also counties. And so that's where the confusion starts to come in.
And campuses.
And campuses,
that as well.
That's right.
Can you tell us of a few of the cities and others that might be falling under that tent of sanctuary city right now?
Yeah, so first of all, there are sanctuary cities that name themselves as sanctuary cities. These are the big ones like San Francisco that we hear about, Chicago, Milwaukee. But there are also sanctuary cities that operate in a more implicit way and don't name themselves as such. But certainly San Francisco, New York, the big cities are the place where we see most conversation around this term.
So these are big cities, but do they have the power to have a dramatic effect on immigration policy in the United States, or is this more a point of friction where there's some disagreement about how we want to enforce immigration in the country?
I think it's both. So if we think about our big cities, this is where many undocumented communities live, and so the notion of sanctuary city matters greatly. Imagine being undocumented and not feeling like you can trust your law enforcement officials in your city. That breeds an amount of distrust and fear. And so in that way, yeah, this really matters. In another way, immigration is a federal, is a part of the federal government. And so I think we're sensing a bit of friction between cities and the federal government.
Was there any of the friction you talk about or political back and forth during the Obama administration and in his efforts to work with immigration policy, or is this something new that we're seeing with the Trump administration?
So it did happen during the Obama administration. Obama implemented a program called Secure Communities, which was to encourage a relationship between local law enforcement, like county sheriffs and ICE officials. There was a sense during the Obama administration that local law enforcement were mandated to do that. That was pushed back, and so there was incentivizing of relationships. And so this is not a new thing with the Trump administration.
And what was your initial reaction to the original executive order issued in late January that was going to deny federal funding to these so-called sanctuary cities? What did you think of that?
So, I mean, it's followed along with the campaign rhetoric that we heard all along. And in many ways, that executive order was not a surprise. We heard about it during the campaign. And so it certainly wasn't a surprise to me to see that being one of the first things that President Trump did upon entering office. I think I did think about it also in terms of the relationship between the federal government and money that comes from the federal government to cities and what that looks like, how that plays out.
In terms of leverage, as you were getting it there, the power dynamic, is this a big stick that the federal government could wield against sanctuary cities denying some funding?
I think the question is, what federal funding could they limit? And so the 10th Amendment makes it pretty clear that policies that are implemented, relationships between federal funding, there has to be some sort of connection between the policy and the funding that is being either taken away or given. And so that's, I think, an important question here.
And that's at issue. And the city of San Francisco is the first to sue the Trump administration over this executive order. How are immigration matters, as we know, handled in San Francisco? Why do you think this happened in San Francisco first?
San Francisco has been time and again the sort of centerpiece to the Sanctuary Cities movement. They implemented their Sanctuary Cities Act in 1989 and has really organized around that in many ways, and have continued to create further policies under the umbrella of the sanctuary city law that give undocumented communities more leeway to use social services and to trust local law enforcement. So it's created an atmosphere of trust and cooperation, I think, more.
And we don't have to get too deep into the legal weeds here, but what was the argument from the city of San Francisco about their case and where we stand so far with this?
So a primary aspect of the case is that it wasn't, I think the city of San Francisco was fearing loss of a lot of funds, but marginal funds in relation to immigration. And so their main argument was that it's not constitutional. There's no right here to put in danger funds for helping public housing, for example, that there's no basis there in the law. That was the main piece.
And that it has to flow through Congress, not
exactly.
From the White House.
That's right. That Congress holds the purse strings for how funding is doled out.
And there was also some talk, especially from the judge presiding in that case in San Francisco, who was saying that he saw a discrepancy between what government lawyers argued in court about the effect and the impact,
yeah,
the scope of it all, really, and what the Trump administration officials said in public.
That's right.
What
so,
did they say?
Yeah, Trump is documented as saying, I'm going to use this as a weapon against you. And the attorneys in the case said, no, it's really marginal, the effect. That this isn't going to be used to cut all public spending to cities. It's going to be marginal. And so there was a real disconnect between the public rhetoric and the legal rhetoric in the case.
We're talking with Sarah McKinnon now from UW-Madison, talking about news that a federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's attempt to withhold federal funds to so-called sanctuary cities.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the concept of sanctuary cities, sanctuary communities that don't fully cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement? What do you think about President Trump's executive order threatening a cutoff of funds and this court ruling saying President Trump, at least temporarily, can't do that? What do you think about the immigration policy you're seeing so far in the first 100 days of the Trump administration? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now about immigration policy under President Trump with Sarah McKinnon from UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about immigration policy under President Trump, about sanctuary cities and other communities? Have you personally been affected by this federal immigration debate? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jeff joining us in Waukesha. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I struggle with this back and forth because I see both sides of the conversation. But one thing that always sticks out is we always say these are undocumented people, but reality is they're not here legally. And so if you are not here legally, say living in a non-sanctuary city, you should have the same rights as anyone here. If we're going to say, for example, Milwaukee has a sanctuary city, it just seems like you're discriminating those other people that are undocumented, that are not able to get to those cities. They're treated differently. So I think the law should either go one way or the other. It's either include all undocumented people or, you know, abide by the law. The law is you're undocumented, just like if I'm driving right now without my driver's license. If I drive through Milwaukee and it's okay, but as soon as I get to Kenosha, you must have your license. It's a very, very, you know, unclear. You know, they're not legally here. So why are we spending money to give them benefits? I guess I'll let you comment on that.
Jeff, thanks for that. And Sarah, he's saying essentially the law should be applied across the board. Some residents in certain cities might be getting additional protections that somewhere else, a citizen somewhere else, or an undocumented immigrant might not have. So what do you think about that argument?
So this is really a question about the relationship between local law enforcement and federal immigration enforcement. These are two separate matters. The reason that we might advocate for local law enforcement not to be connected, not to have a relationship with ICE officials, is so that people living in all of our communities can access the services that they need. So imagine if you're a domestic violence survivor and you fear going to police, you fear going to the hospital to access social services. These are separate matters, and so really the question about sanctuary is about the relationship between the federal government and local law officials.
And the city of San Francisco made the additional argument that this would cost them money, the federal government immigration plan, because they wouldn't have the cooperation that they had right now, the open doors with law enforcement, which could lead to incurred costs for the city.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't. So first of all, it's the taking away of the money if they don't do it. I'm not sure about what extra costs, but certainly there would be legal costs associated with it.
Thank you for that call. And we'll take another now from Jim joining us in Hurley. Jim, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment in regards to this. Pretty much a non-believer in the sanctuary city. In regards to Trump getting in regards to the topic we're talking about, I've been a lifelong Democrat voter. I ended up switching and voting Republican this time in regards to decisions like this, in regards to Trump being harder on immigration stands and things like this. And I think maybe there's a lot of people that were lifelong Democrat voters that ended up switching to Trump because they felt he would actually do something in regards to his stance on immigration. And I'm proud to say that that he got in and that he's actually going to do something.
Jim, thank you for that call. And President Trump has made the argument since the campaign trail that crime was being committed by illegal immigrants and that he wanted to get you. He's been calling them the bad guys out, and to focus on that as a point of kind of law and order and protecting citizens. And he's pointed often to the killing of Catherine Steinle during his arguments about sanctuary cities. Can you talk about that case?
I think what's fascinating about this, the question about crime, is that President Obama deported more undocumented individuals than any other president before him. And if we look at the numbers of the first few months of President Trump in office, the numbers are the same. There's no more raising in deportations. There's been a raise in detentions, but the raise in detention has been of non-criminal individuals, so individuals that don't have a criminal record. And so I think we're seeing an interesting disconnect between the political discussion, the public message, and what's bearing out in reality. The case of Catherine Steiner, in a lot of ways, that's an exceptional example. Certainly, violent things happen, bad things happen. But if you look at the statistics, immigrants are not more violent than other individuals in this country. In fact, pretty significantly less.
What do you think has changed for immigration policy in America in the almost 100 days since President Trump took office? And what's the prospect for the future with some of these these law cases that are still unresolved and will be fought down the road?
I think we're going to see more detentions. So detention, ICE arrests have been happening at a significant rate. Immigration arrests rose 32% in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. So I think we're going to see more of that. The memorandum that came out about a month ago that named who is in fear of deportation basically named anyone who has a status that's non-citizen. So anyone is really under threat of deportation. It really gave a lot of parameters for who could be detained and who could be deported. And so I think in a lot of ways we're seeing a rise of fear and a rise of politicizing of the debate and the conversation around immigration.
And we've been talking about how the Trump administration was looking to use funding to these cities as a way to get compliance for immigration policy. Are there other tools that the federal government could use that might be distinct from this funding to cities? Are there other aspects that could come into play?
Well, I mean, we are seeing that. So ICE has a number of capacities to do that. And under the Trump administration, I think we see the ICE office using their power to do raids and detentions with more frequency. That, I think, is going to happen more. And immigrant communities around the country are really fearful of this. I mean, we've really seen a rise in fear amongst immigrant communities around the country, Wisconsin included. And I think that's significant to pay attention to the human aspect of what this means as well.
And do you expect there to be more in terms of legal battles in these clashes between the federal government and local governments about where one's jurisdiction ends and another's begins?
Certainly, absolutely. And as the executive orders continue to be introduced, I think we're going to see continued challenges, especially in relation to the relationship between the federal government and states, as well as cities, really challenging the constructs of federalism and how that plays out.
Let's take one more caller here. We've got Rich joining us in Gail's Corners. Rich, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I feel that if you come over here legally, you already know you're breaking the law. So you're coming over here legally, and then you're expecting to be treated like a citizen who has been born here and has all the legal rights. Usually when you're coming over here, you have nothing anyways. So when the first thing they're doing, everything they're doing from that point that they're here, is going to be an illegal act.
And I'm going to jump in, Rich, so we're just about out of time. Sarah, is there a sense about where public opinion lies with this question?
Public opinion, I think, is quite divided. I think we have, in some ways, two really strong opinions on the question of immigration and not a lot of in between. And I think, you know, as we move on this issue, on this conversation, we need to explore the how do we get to the in between.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for coming by the studio and talking today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
That was Sarah McKinnon, Associate Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, joining us to talk about news that a federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's effort to withhold money from so-called sanctuary cities.